Hi, everyone. My name is Claire Tixer. I work at the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. And first of all, apologies for starting this panel late. We finished the last panel, which was so exciting and rich, late, and therefore we are delayed. But forgive us. And I am very honored that we were able to bring the people who are next to me in this room today, because they are four very brilliant individuals. First of all, we have Nyaka Sururumboro, who is a co-founder of the association Berlin Postcolonial. Welcome.
Thank you.
We have Christian Bomarius, who is a German jurist, author, and journalist. Come up his book. We have Christophe Marchand, who is a Belgian lawyer, co-founder of the law firm Jus Cogens. Welcome. And last but not least, we have Lisbeth Zegveld, who is a lawyer from the Netherlands, with the Praxis, sorry, I'm mixing a little bit, with the law firm Bracken d'Oliveira. And she is also a professor on war reparations at the University of Amsterdam. So that, welcome.
You shouldn't say that anymore.
I'm so not saying it, I didn't
no
say it.
No professor.
Yes. Welcome. So in this panel, we're going to be covering many different contexts, many different topics. We're going to be talking about the colonial crimes and powers that were led by Germany, by the Netherlands, by Belgium. We're going to touch on countries from Indonesia to Tanzania to Cameroon to the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're going to be hearing about very atrocious crimes ranging from mass murders, sexualized violence, political assassinations, or the very unbelievable confiscation of skulls and human remains of colonized people killed by the colons, confiscation that's still happening to this day. So we have four people here who've spent a whole lot of energy trying to deconstruct this wall of silence, this wall of ignorance that very conveniently protects colonial crimes and colonial and racist legacies. For people who've turned their solidarity into action using many different routes, civil litigation, criminal litigation, research, publication of a book, advocacy, activism, people who basically have not accepted the status quo, but are instead challenging it at its core, within the system. These are people also who are working very closely with many other people. This is not a single person type of enterprise that you take. So this is also stories of networking, partnerships with people, communities, movements. So all of them are part of movements who are making an impact on history. And we want to hear about all the challenges that come with that. The challenges are certainly massive, as we heard very eloquently yesterday and today from Mutua, from Engin, and from many of the other speakers, law is politics. It was designed to serve the powerful. And Western legal culture, in particular, was used as a tool to further the imperial project in many ways. And in particular, international human rights law works at its very best against the weak, against the fallen, against those who are who've lost, against the South a lot of time. So this is where it works at best. Double standards in the application of international human rights is not something you can today deny. And this is what I really liked that Tony Engie yesterday in his keynote speech was saying, that this lack of accountability of the West is part of this modern vision of the civilizing mission. Human rights is about power. It's obviously not just a question of law. That would be very easy. And it is this power that strategic human rights litigation is seeking to challenge. At least this is our vision at ECCHR. And it's trying to rebalance this asymmetry, precisely challenging how power translates into selectivity, selectivity of who is accountable for what, but most importantly, of who is not accountable for what not. It's about bringing cases that have a chance of making an impact, of have a chance of touching a system, because it touches on a systemic issue. But very importantly, justice cannot be built by lawyers alone. Justice needs to be built by people. Otherwise, it wouldn't make the difference that we are seeking to achieve. And this comes back to what I was talking about, the importance of partnership, collaborations, working with a whole range of actors, from journalists, lawyers, communities, movements, together. And it also means that success is not going to be assessed in a very conventional way, necessarily. Of course, it's great to win before the courts. You have. It's amazing. However, there are also other types of success, because bringing legal efforts or doing the other type of work that people are doing all contribute to impacting a debate, impacting a public debate, possibly impacting decision, encouraging others to act, changing the system a little bit. Having repercussions, since that's the title of this symposium. Professor Dhawan referred yesterday to Audre Lorde's quote, and she said, well, maybe the master's tools can dismantle the master's house. And I think with these types of efforts, we can certainly dismantle the master's bedroom, bathroom, these places without which the house is not so nice to live in anymore. And that's already a great start. So something else that Engi said yesterday is that he thinks that reparations are one of the greatest way to challenge imperialism. And that's why it's so hard, and that's why it's a political process. So I'm very happy to turn to you, Lisbeth, because you have successfully litigated, unexpectedly successfully litigated, I'm talking from a political perspective, not from a legal perspective, obviously, litigated for widows and survivors of war crimes in Indonesia to get reparations from the Netherlands government. And it's led to, it's been a huge legal saga, a huge political saga, and you should tell us about this uphill battle.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I wasn't there yesterday, unfortunately, but reparation and imperialism. I guess it explains a lot, the uphill battle, because it definitely is. I guess it very much depends where you litigate. I think we are in a good jurisdiction in the Netherlands. I must say, it was a question that I wanted to ask, but I thought I'm on a panel, so that just not take up this time. But to say up front to go to a US court rather than to a German court with regard to the Herero case, because Germany, the German institutions, the government, and the court system are all on the same side, is quite a statement to make, for at least from a lawyer's perspective. And fortunately, in the Netherlands, I do not feel forced to make such a statement that we have to take such cases outside the Netherlands in order to obtain justice. Though I must say that we've litigated 13 years for the victims of Srebrenica, who were forced out of the United Nations compound by Dutch military in 1995. And I must say there have been moments that I thought this case can only be done by either an international tribunal or by a foreign jurisdiction and not by the Dutch court. But that I mean, at some point we found a hearing here, and we won an appeal, and we won before the Supreme Court. But the Indonesian cases, we have an apology list in the Netherlands. There's a bureau that draws up apologies ranking from top to bottom each year, which apologies are best received and which apologies are least best received. And in 2011, the apologies extended by the Dutch government to the widows of a village on Java, Indonesia, were ranking at the top of that apology list. These were the widows of Rawakadee that were receiving these apologies. Rawakadee is a village that is some 100 kilometers from Jakarta on Java, former East Indies. People of the village were attacked in 1947. The Dutch military were looking for an independence fighter, Mr. Custario, who was said to be hiding in the village. They couldn't find him, and next thing they did, the Dutch military did, was burning down the entire village, but also rounding up all the men and boys and killing, well, at a minimum 150 men. The villagers themselves say that they killed 430 men. There's a graveyard there. I went there myself. I counted 198 graves, so that's at least a minimum. But they said that many were buried outside the village or instantaneously on the spot where they were killed. Just very brief. I mean, in the independence war, we had the former Dutch Indies were colonized by the Netherlands in 1800 until the Second World War, when Sukarno and Hartto proclaimed the independence. The Netherlands didn't recognize this initially, and they said, let's conclude a treaty, and then we'll have a gradual independence of Indonesia, and then that would then last, the transition period would last until 49. The implementation of the treaty gave rise to disputes and an independence war or a post-colonial war, how you want to name it, erupted. And we are believed to have killed between 100,000 to 150,000 Indonesian people, both in wartime, but also as a standard policy execution of men, as standard of examples setting to guerrilla fighters and Indonesian army that had been created by that time, that this was the Dutch response. That is the background. The Rawakadee case came forward at some point thanks to a foundation who reached out to us. The Rawakadee case, none of these cases, none of these executions were criminally investigated at the time. And in 2008, we decided to take this case to court for those widows who were still alive, and that were nine of them. And in 2011, the Dutch court in The Hague granted their claim for compensation. Maybe good to explain first why we decided to go for litigation. Were there other options? And other options were relevant to us because these widows were all in the back of their 80s. They were at least 85, but some of them were even past 90 years old. And commencing legal procedures, these procedures tend to take quite long, a huge chance that they wouldn't survive these procedures. And so, the question, of course, whether that would be the best answer we could give. Also, and that's a very difficult aspect, I find, as a lawyer to address, but maybe it's also views from the audience or from the panel. What I understood from the widows is that they, to say it very simply, that they weren't angry, they weren't resentful. They weren't out there for litigation. They weren't there to say, and now we want this or that from the government. It was more that they were looking for someone to reach out to them to say, hey, yeah, we left your village. We never came back. We never said anything about it anymore. Can we shake hands? Can we perhaps close this book? It was, I mean, it's difficult to say if you work for 9 people and they're of a very different generation and you don't speak their language to really understand what they're after. But for one example, there's still Dutch military alive who are responsible for these, not these very crimes, but who are responsible for some of these crimes. In general, they didn't want any criminal prosecution. No way. They wanted to reach out to the government, but they didn't want any personal interaction with military or any personal complaint against another person. And they said many times to me, we aren't angry with this military. They did what they did, and most likely they were instructed to do what they did. So in the early stages, I really hoped that we could reach an out-of-court settlement in this case. The case got enormous media attention when we announced that we were looking at the case. It aroused emotions countrywide, really with a magnitude that no one had foreseen. It became visible that it seemed like every family in the Netherlands had somehow a root in Indonesia, still had some family member or otherwise a link with former Dutch Indies. And so everyone, it really erupted a discussion on how to deal with this past. The state lawyer called me and he said, can we talk? Because he, you know, the state really had, in a way, suffered from all this attention, wanted to deal with it. And I remember coming to his office and there was a huge pile of media articles on his desk. And I thought, well, that illustrates the impact of the case. And that may be my leverage, my power, so to speak, to force a solution. What happened, and we heard this also this morning, our Minister of Foreign Trade decided to donate, to give development aid to the village of Rawakade, €500,000 again. So that was something that also came in the media and it was published that said, okay, the state is going to assist the village, going to support the village and thereby acknowledging it, that it existed, but not much more, just giving this money. And I said, well, maybe we can create a link with this, between this money, this donation, this aid, and the case. If we can manage to issue such a link, then maybe we can drop the case, but that may be the end of it. And I thought, well, maybe with the money, the village would establish an hospital or a school, and I visualized that we could attach words like in commemoration of all the men of Rawakade who had, you know, had been killed, had been murdered by the Dutch military. And perhaps for the widows, that would be a gesture that they would welcome and that would be sufficient for them. But that was not open to discussion, really. No such link could be made. It was really an action of missionary charity. That's it. That, just like we heard this morning with Ohiro, we're doing this. And again, it's what's been said this morning. We give you something. You should be grateful. You're receiving. We're the givers. But we're not giving because we bear responsibility. And that was, for them and for me as well, that was the end of it. I mean, if that cannot be done, then we continue. And and what remained was really litigation. Now, I wouldn't say that I expected litigation to be easy. Honestly, I expected to fail. And I must also be frank with you that I wasn't eager at all to start litigation because, we're dealing with a case that was quite old, of course. It was the insistence of, of the foundation, the intermediary between the widows and us, that was really very insistent and just wouldn't give up. And that pulled us across the threshold to pick up this case. As I said, the reason where why we were reserved were the time bars, the statute of limitation. This case was 65 years old when it came to us. And the statute of limitation is at most 30 years. In normal case, it's 5 years. So, I mean, being a lawyer, I mean, you can feel that that there's a good cause in the case and it has to be brought. But to know from the beginning that you fail is a bit, in my profession, is a bit. And indeed, the state in the procedure, I mean, we did decide to bring the case. The reason that we did is that time bars have to be invoked by the other parties. Time bars is not a legal instrument that's applied by the court on its own initiative. So you bring a case, if the other party decides that it's not appropriate to invoke time bars, then they don't. It's for them to say, we lack the evidence to defend ourselves, we find that you're too late. For other reasons, we find that, you know, it's reasonable to invoke these time bars, but it's their decision. If they don't raise it, the court won't address it. And I thought, in view of all this media attention and the weight of the case, I thought, well, let them do that. And maybe we see what happens afterward. Let them in court say, you are too late. And I thought that may be a good point, or a good moment that we should all experience. Now, just briefly on time bars, because these are, I think, for litigating these type of cases, they are killing. These are really very, they stop every litigation, not criminal litigation, that's interesting. So prosecution of international crimes, war crimes, international crimes, can be done endlessly these days. The limitation period has been abolished. But that's a decision for the prosecutor, and the prosecutor is a state institute. For private parties, parties like the widows, others who have an older case, limitation period under the majority of national jurisdictions is still maintained, exists. And these are very, very limited periods of time. As I said, it's some states have 3 years, 5 years, and then perhaps with a maximum of a few decades, but then it stops. So for really these old historical injustices, they are really putting up a huge threshold. International law doesn't help you at all. Human rights standards have no view on statute of limitations. The European Court of Human Rights has said that limitation rules as such do not violate human rights. So you really have to rely on national standards. And in we managed in a few cases now to circumvent them, fortunately, but exceptions are rarely accepted by courts. Now, in this case, the court said, yes, well, the state first said, you're too late, they did. The court then said, yes, the case is time barred, you're too late. But then there's an exception, a general principle of reasonableness and fairness. That's in every legal system, you have these open norms, and we relied heavily on these norms to explain that if they would invoke it, then, you know, there's something about perhaps morality, good faith, that it was unacceptable. And it's kind of an escape provision, a catch-all provision. I heard judges saying later after this case that as a judge you're only allowed to use such an this rule on this principle of fairness and reasonableness only once in your career. So you're not allowed as a judge to just pick it out of the drawer as you feel fit. Now, of course, the court had extensively explain and reason why they found that this principle could be applied to this case. It's a ruling you can read. We have it here have it translated into English. They said to summarize. It concerns very grave acts, summary executions of people who were our citizens. It was our colony, so it was for a moment. It was Dutch law that applied, and we killed our own citizens at the time because we hadn't accepted the independence of Indonesia. So it was all on the Dutch law, and there was a local law as well, the Adat law, as it was mentioned this morning, that you have this unfairness in legal systems that apply, you know, to different groups in one country. Yes, there was, but the state didn't dare to invoke different legal systems for these people. So it was Dutch law that applied at the time, both in the Netherlands and in Indonesia. And under that law, no international law, nothing, very basic, wrongful act, executions. And then the court said the Netherlands has been totally passive over the last 65 years. It has done really nothing in order to address these crimes. As I said, they left and that was basically it. The court also importantly pointed to the inability of the widows to access the court, to obtain justice in the domestic court in the Netherlands. It first pointed out that the widows couldn't go to a local court in Indonesia because in Indonesia the Netherlands enjoys immunity. You can't sue a foreign state. Maybe in the Herero case they can, but in principle you cannot sue a foreign state in a court. So if the widows had gone to their own court, which our court may have expected from them, the Netherlands would have enjoyed immunity. So the court said, we really, you know, in order to obtain justice, they had to come to us. And that clearly threw up a threshold for these people. And they said there were all kind of practical obstacles, which we also elaborated on a lot in court. Illiteracy, no access to a lawyer. We had experts in courts explaining what to expect from people in these kind of cases. No means, of course, no financial support in order to bring a case. And that was all for the court quite relevant to come to this ruling. And so, conclusion, the court held the Netherlands responsible for the massacre in Rawakadee in 49. Now, back to the apologies. The court ordered the Netherlands to make reparations. And it's not an easy question, what is the best form of reparations in this type of case? And I must say, and I won't speak about it this afternoon, but these widows, each of these widows got 20,000 euros from the Netherlands, something that we negotiated. What happened with that money in the village is a completely different story, and it's not an easy story. The point is that, of course, these massacres hit the entire village. We represented 9 widows and 1 surviving male. But the village, I mean, there were children, there were grandchildren, there were other people. In fact, the whole village, I mean, the memorial is just, you know, overarching in this village. It's present all around. So the entire village feels connected to this massacre. So to decide to go, to choose for 20,000 euros each person would really isolate these cases out of the bigger context. And that was a basis that we said, well, wouldn't apology be also an option? Of course, all in discussion with the widows, but it's not easy. These people don't live like, you know, isolated individuals. They also live in the village context. And well, there's a lot to be learned there. How to deal with a Western court system that applies its laws and its reparation system to a local situation. I mean, I as a lawyer was not allowed to say, well, you know, give a lump sum to the entire village and they decide what to do with it. I mean, I represent these people and I have to make sure that they get the money they're entitled to. And please, most of them, you know, as much as possible. So the state offered an amount And I negotiated if, you know, if we go for that amount, but we also want an apology. So it went up and it went down. And okay, we ended up with apologies, which were well received. The money is one thing. Money is always a source of conflict. Apologies went were very well received. 9 December 2011, 66 years after the massacre, the Dutch ambassador, not the prime minister, no, it's still politics, Dutch ambassador in Jakarta, he traveled to Rawakadee, but it was on the day of the commemoration of the massacre, it was exactly the right day, and that was a huge event, the widows, the entire world press, I was there, went there, of course, it was amazing what happened there. The ambassador spoke the carefully drafted words that we had seen beforehand, and we weren't allowed to comment on it, but I said, you're not going to say something I haven't seen. So we had seen them, and for ourselves, we agreed with it, and he said, and I quote him, "In this context, and on behalf of the Dutch government, I apologize for the tragedy that took place in Rawakadee on the 9th of December, 47. And he repeated it in the Indonesian language, and it were like hundreds of people were there, and they applauded, and it was an amazing, amazing moment. Now, why were these apologies so well received? There is an assumption among the public at large that people in these cases always want money. I always have to explain when I do this type of litigation, oh God, is it again, do they want, you know, to be paid by the government? For lawyers, from a lawyer's perspective, I must say, money is often, and also for the people themselves, money is often the only instrument, the only means left in order to compensate. If your husband is executed, or your child, there's no other way to, or difficult to find sometimes to address such an injustice. There are, of course, whole theories on, you know, why money in our culture and why not something else. It also disentangles the perpetrator from the receivers. You give me your money, my money, I have nothing else to do with you anymore, and I decide what I do with it. So it also gives people some independence on in this form of redress. From a legal point of view, I must say lawyers also do contribute a bit to the more money-driven litigation, because apologies are often considered to be soft. You cannot enforce them. As I said, I was allowed to look at the text that the ambassador was going to speak, but and fairly so, you can't comment on the text. I can't say, you have to say this and that, because it makes no sense. Then they become my apology, they become my words. So it's you put it in the hands of someone else, hoping and expecting that in that sense it will be a true apology, that it in some way speaks from someone else's or the government's heart. And for lawyers, that's scary area. I mean, and certainly when you talk, you know, when we're dealing with governments, what is it, the heart of a government, or what are the words of a government? What is it worth? This time the apologizing, you could also wonder, I mean, why was it received so well? Of course, another point you could raise, 65 years later, to apologize for something 65 years later, that's quite late. And by the way, a court order was necessary in order to bring our government to that point. These are valid questions, I think. For these widows, they weren't after money. They, as I said, very little resentment. They wanted a form of recognition. They said that time and time again. And that was also why I think the apologies were well received, because that fits in their expectations. That fit in how they had experienced this whole tragedy. Now the apologies were also regarded as sincere by them and by others, by the outside world, because they were not entirely spontaneous, but they were sincere in the sense that the facts were fully recognized. Worst thing is for a victim if they're not believed or that facts are shrouded in secrecy. So the facts were, there wasn't any dispute on what had happened. And that was also, these lines of apologies that I read out to you were just a few lines, but that was included in what the government had to say. And that, so it was apology for what had truly happened and not apology for you know, only part of the story. Now the timing was extremely important because the apologies were issued, 64 years later, but swiftly after the judgment of the court. 3 months later, this judgment was ruled in September 2011, and the apologies were extended in December. The state did not appeal, which is very, very exceptional in our country, I must say that. I mean, the court system is one thing, the state behavior is something else. They appeal everything. They didn't appeal this. And within 3 months, we had reached this settlement, and we all flew to Jakarta, and this is what they did. And so there was some kind of a spontaneity, some kind of a sincerity, honesty, which felt, which apparently felt good. These apologies were extended on the day of their commemoration, 9 December. So also in that sense, the timing was good, and they were extended in the village of the widows. So that is it was the right place where they were extended. The forgiving words work best when the violator comes to the victim. If you ask the victim to come to you, already the levels are different. You're staying where you are, and someone has to come to you. So the fact that we were prepared to travel to that village was quite an important aspect. The ambassador went there. He met the widows. He shook hands with them. He addressed them personally, and he went to the monument commemorating the deaths. So, now, where are we with the other Indonesian cases? Because it set off so many other cases. Not something I was hesitant, I must say. You should never repeat your own success. That's from a professional point of view. I thought, well, we've done that. That's it. But of course, the foundation said, listen, which I didn't know that much of, there's so many more cases. We're talking about 100,000 to 150,000 victims. Why stop? So we traveled from Rawakadee, that in December we traveled to South Sulawesi. In South Sulawesi, it's claimed to have been 40,000 victims or people killed there. So we continued with cases on behalf of widows from South Sulawesi, which triggered an out-of-court settlement, a drawing up of an out-of-court settlement by the state. So we now have a regulation and a settlement agreement between all the widows in a similar position as the Rawakadee case, who are entitled to each 20,000 euros. That was the consequence of the South Sulawesi case. And we have now settled 40 cases in total, some 800,000 euros, which is, of course, I mean, yeah, it's good that it worked, but it's, of course, a very small number out of the total number of victims. But most of them have passed away. Now, then the next question was the children. Elisabeth, why not the children? I say, yeah, why not the children? I don't know. I mean, if my father would be killed, I would feel I would be perhaps in a stronger position than if my husband would be killed. My husband's not here, but I think why? What is the argument to say that a child is in a different position than a widow? And there were, of course, the children. There are so many more because they're younger. So we decided to bring the children case to court as well, and the court ruled accordingly and said they are in a similar or even stronger position than the widows. So they have to be compensated as well. And we brought finally a case on sexual crime, a rape case, and torture, which we may discuss later. That was, for me, the executions I could, in a way, If the government would allow this case to go forward, we were talking about, it would really set a precedent, a huge number of cases. The rape cases, the rape case was really one case. We have an outspoken policy of our Ministry of Foreign Affairs how to deal with rape in Syria, in cases where we have a relation, countries where we have a relationship with. And now we had a government saying in court that rape was not as serious as execution. They just said it like that in court. And so the time bar should apply to the rape case. Because we said if you accept an out-of-court settlement for the executions, then also accept it for the rape case. This woman is still here. Her evidence, everything is strong. And the only argument by the states was rape is not as serious as execution, and so the time bar should apply to this case. Remember, the first argument of the court to dismiss the time bar was the gravity, the seriousness of the crimes that we were talking about. The court dismissed the argument and said rape is as serious, and she received some 8,000 euros compensation. And a torture case, finally. The man passed away in September. Unfortunately, he had just given testimony in court through Skype. Very good way of providing evidence in court. We had a Skype link with Malang, East Java, and the Dutch court. And he testified. He was there in his wheelchair, and he told the whole story. And he passed away a month later. And we're now, the court's now looking at expert statements that are looking into photographs that we took of his injuries, head injuries and all that, because there's nothing else, of course, there's no written evidence. It's just testimony of people and the scars that people may have. And we had these photographs and an expert's looking into these photographs, and the court has to decide one of these days whether there's enough evidence to grant this claim as well. But finally, the hitting, I thought maybe it's good to, it's not all of a success story. Last November, the court ruled that there are now hundreds of cases pending from children, 520 cases we have. These cases are not court ready. They're not, the evidence is not ready to go to court. I can't bring them to court just like that because we lack sufficient proof. So we present them to court in different batches, and the court said now for the last batch in November that these children were too late. They said the first victory, or our first decision, was in 2011, the Rabakadé case, and these children should have moved on immediately to bring their own case because they knew that this court would be receptive to their case, and you cannot wait until 2016 with bringing your case. And I have now decided not to appeal this case, but to follow a different strategy. But it makes no sense in just keep going and knowing that you're going to lose. At some point, we're now really hitting the wall of legal intervention. I think that's how far it can get.
Well, you went really far. So, yeah. I think we would all like to go to that wall that you just mentioned, because up until the last cases you mentioned, it sounds like you live almost on a different planet. I mean, it's outstanding and so very, very inspiring. We'll go back to some other aspects after. I want to, like I mentioned in the beginning, we're going to be touching on the very different contexts and time of history. We're now going to switch to Lumumba and the independence of Congo. So I'm turning to Christophe Marchand. Patrice Lumumba is a is a huge figure and a hero to many for independence movements throughout. And as you probably know, months before he was, as you probably know, a few months after the independence of Congo, he was imprisoned, tortured, and murdered. He had been the very first elected prime minister after the independence. And there is a letter that he wrote to his wife as he was, the very last letter that he sent to his wife before he was killed. And I want to find it because I want to read a very short part of it. This is already as he knows what is happening. He writes to his wife, and later in the letter he says, "To my sons, who I am leaving and whom perhaps I shall not see again, I want to say that the future of the Congo is splendid, and that I expect from them, as from every Congolese, the fulfillment of the sacred tasks of restoring our independence and our sovereignty. Without dignity, there is no freedom. Without justice, there is no dignity. And without independence, there are no free men. The day will come when history will speak, but it will not be the history which will be taught in Brussels, Paris, Washington, or the United Nations. It will be the history which will be taught in the countries which have won freedom from colonialism and its puppets." And last week marks 57 years that he was assassinated. Now, Christophe, you will tell us about the role of Congo, because the sons that he addressed in his letter are part of the family that you represent in a case that you filed, a criminal case. This time we're talking about a criminal case that we filed in order to look at the responsibility of former Belgian officials in the assassination of Lumumba. Before, can you tell us about the context in general and how what happened in Belgium up until you filed the case? Because a parliamentary commission was initiated and concluded that, or recognized that Belgium had moral responsibility in the murder of Lumumba, but refused to take any further type of responsibility.
Yes, thank you for inviting me to talk about this case. The first thing is about the context is to remember a bit what is the history of Congo with Leopold II, the King of Belgium, going to Congo in the mid of the 19th century, sending some people to steal all the territory and to make it its private property. So it was its private property, and afterwards he gave this huge territory, very rich, to the Belgian government and to the Belgian state. And so that's how the colony became under the heir of Belgium. And then times goes on, we know that there have been like millions of killings by Leopold II, that's what he said, everywhere except in Belgium, with something, no one hears that, but that's only fact and history. But then we arrive to 1960, so independence of Congo, 1960, first prime minister elected, Patrice Lumumba, and very quickly Belgium feels that they're going to lose the money they got from Congo. I mean, it's a very rich country, especially in one region, which is Katanga, where there is a lot of minerals. He said that the uranium that was used to bomb Hiroshima came from Congo. So a lot of rich companies, Belgian companies, organized somehow that this decolonization process would stop and that there would not be independence. So Patrice Lumumba, we are in June 60, elected prime minister, and 1 month after, Katanga, this rich region, said, "We are independent from Congo. We are a secession, so they create a new state, independent, but in fact, this new state is governed by Belgians. There is sort of shadow cabinet, as we name it. It means that every minister in Katanga has a Belgian who's sitting aside and who's taking the decisions. And so Katanga does the secession. Lumumba tries to call for United Nations. Troops are sent by United Nations. Belgian troops are coming. 10,000 Belgian troops arrive in Congo. And then he's arrested. That is September 1960. His the new prime minister is Mr. Mobutu. We all know that will be then the president until, I don't know where he died, but it was in the 90s or 80s, late 80s. And then he was murdered in January. In January 61. In all this same framework, the discussion was, but where was he killed? He was killed in Katanga. That was the first fact. And how was it killed? And how did it come that he arrived in Katanga, where in Katanga was his worst enemy, who was the chief of the president of Katanga. And finally, Belgium, in the beginning, was lying a lot, was doing sort of, I would say, public disinformation about what was happening in Congo. And then, and that's important to follow this chronology to from this independence to today, I would say, is that then there was a big reaction internationally, because Patrice Lumumba was very important, like a new figure of decolonialism. And so directly there was an investigation that was led by the United Nations, I think it was 1965, about who assassinated Lumumba, because that was the big question, who assassinated Lumumba. And then afterwards you even had parliamentary investigation in the US by the Senate in 1975, because there was like rumors that the US had assassinated Lumumba. And then finally in Belgium, more and more people was talking about, did we had a role in this assassination? And very important was a book that was written by Ludo de Wit, who wrote a book that had a very big impact. And so the government was obliged to create a parliamentary commission, and that's make a very deep investigation, digging in all the archives of the Belgians administration, of the colonial administration, and bringing to light everything what happened between the Belgians that were in Katanga. I was talking to you about this shadow cabinet that was in Katanga, and the ambassadors that were not in Kinshasa, but in the other Congo, the other side of the river, if you know a bit of the geography over there, and the administration in Brussels. And so it was really pure administrative communication that was showing that it was organized to send Lumumba, when he was arrested, to Katanga, where he would be killed. That was something very clear, and that afterwards, when he was killed, there were some Belgian policemen were charged to take his body and to destroy his body by smelting him by acid in around the villa where he was killed. So this investigation in 2001 was a big moment, because then Belgium recognized that they were morally responsible for the assassination of Lumumba. Of course, we had all the evidence in the file. So in the time, there was no question about, are we going to do an investigation, a criminal investigation? Are we going to do a civil claim? Or no, it was enough. And I think it was as far as the Belgian society could have been going in the time in 2001. So afterwards, then there were still this question, because there was a foundation that was created by the Belgian state to compensate somehow the killing of Patrice Lumumba. But then the family of Patrice Lumumba, the sons, who I'm representing now, refused to play in that game, because it was, again, not a real compensation. It was just like, we can give you some money to do what we want you to do, which was like creating or democracy in Congo or something, nothing to do with reparation. So at one moment they decided to try to find another way for reparation, and that's why they came up to our law firm asking whether it would be possible to do a case, a legal case, for the assassination of Lumumba in 61. Is that good for a context, or you want more?
No, that's great.
Okay. I can do hours if you want. But.
Great. Tell us about how, in the end, you decided to start litigation. How did the case come to you, and where is it at today? And what are the main legal, political challenges that you're facing?
Well, of course, we have the same problems as we had, like statute of limitation, you know, case 61, what will happen, how can we go over that? Question of immunities, because the persons who are responsible are often high officials, so we always have this kind of question that there are some privilege of jurisdiction, as we say. We cannot prosecute those persons the same manner as me, or because they are ministers or they are prosecutors, and so we had to face all those problems. But so when we saw that it was, we had this huge evidence coming from the parliamentary investigation, it was just like not used, but was very interesting and was enough, according to us, to go to court. Then we begin to think about those problems. So the first thing we did is we went to speak to Wolfgang Kalleck, of course, who, just to have some discussions. And then we met also with Michael Ratner from New York. We had some discussions just to open a bit, like brainstorming about what can we do in this kind of situation about these key questions about statute of limitation, for example. And so you have to know that in Belgium, there's a new law in 2003 that decided that there is no statute of limitation for war crimes. And so we thought, but yes, it's 2003, okay, but in 1961, assassination of Lumumba, if you see this situation with the eyes, the legal eyes, political eyes of 1961, then you consider there was no war over there. It was not a war crime. It was a problem between a decolonized state and the former empire. And that was considered in the time not as a war, it was an internal problem. And that's why Belgium sent 10,000 troops to the Congo, and that the reaction of the United Nations was not, legally speaking, if today this would happen, the United Nations would say, but this is an aggression, this is war. This is war. You are sending 10,000 troops to an independent country. This is really an act of aggression. So, but in the time, it was not how it was framed in the UN literature. In the time, if you see the resolutions of the United Nations State Security Council, but then you had an evolution. In 1978, you had a book written by Abi Saab, who is a very important professor, who afterwards was a judge in the International Court. But in 1978, he published a book about the Congo situation, using the legal terms that had to be used already, but it was not, the time was not ready for that, saying it was a war. And so everything what happened during a war can be considered as a war crime and is not submitted to statute of limitation. You see? Because all the people, also the Belgians we were attacking, they were all in another way of thinking. They were thinking this is not war crimes, there is statute of limitation with 30 years usually in Belgium. So for example, one of the person we are now attacking personally as accomplices of this war crime, it was assassination or torture of Patrice Lumumba, he's a professor, I think, of politics or something, and he wrote his thesis on the assassination of Lumumba. And he was present in Katanga. He was one of the shadow cabinet members. And he published his book with explaining everything, what happened at the time, in 1991, just like 30 years after the case, because he thought he could really speak up and explain everything. And that's something also that's quite interesting in that case, is that all the people never thought that they one day would have to come to court. So they speak very openly about what happened, you know? That's why we are very happy, because we have a lot of evidence everywhere. You know, we have like this documentary also by the German television, where you have this policeman who says, "I have the tooth of Lumumba," which is something very amazing. So the policeman who was supposed to smelt the body said, "I have the tooth of Lumumba," and so he showed the tooth on the television. And it was like a hunt trophy, I would say. It was really horrible. And of course, it was very shocking. And afterwards, when we sent the police, he said, no, I threw it in the sea, or I don't know, something. Years later, which is like 1 year ago, his daughter again made an interview saying, oh, you know, my father, it was not true. He didn't send the tooth in the sea. I have the tooth. And so we sent the police through the prosecutor, and indeed, we found the tooth back. So this is in the hands of the justice, and the justice said, the investigative judge said, we need to do a DNA investigation to confirm this is the tooth of Patrice Lumumba, but if we do this by police techniques, we will destroy the tooth. And so we discussed with the family, and we said, no, we don't want to destroy this. It's the only remain of a body. This is so symbolic, but it's also for the family very important, just to get it back and just to bury this this person in dignity. Now, about the case, so we were working with ECCHR and other lawyers. It took us like 1 year and a half and we worked with a university in Belgium. It took us 1 year and a half to draft the complaint because it's huge material, you know. And so we introduced we filed the complaint. That was in June 2010. That was 50 years, like symbolically, after the independence. And so we were wondering what would happen. And surprisingly enough, we had a lot of support from the prosecutor's office, because there is a specialized prosecutor's office in Belgium, specialized in war crimes and in international crimes. And they followed us in our reinterpretation of the facts as a war crime and not as a usual crime. They said, yeah, you are right, this is a war crime. And it's not barred by statute of limitation. So he said, but before I give the case to an investigative judge, like a judge policeman, I will send a case to court to have a decision from the Court of Appeal of Brussels to state whether it is time barred of what, of not. And so we went to court, we litigated, we pleaded, and we have this decision. This is from 12 December 2012, where the court decided it was not time barred, that they just acknowledged that there is no statute of limitation as we can consider it is a war crime. So that was a huge decision, and then the case was sent to the investigative judge again to say, you can do the investigation. Now we are in the process, the investigation continues. We just went to see the case file, because as victims we can see the file if we ask for. It was last week, and there is now, this is the end of the investigation. We just received I think it's 6,000 pages of unknown document from the UN investigation, and no one ever had this opportunity because it was secret, and the UN just left the secrecy on it and gave it to the Belgian judge. So we're going to see what will happen. What are in those documents? But for me, it's not very important because, as I said, all the evidence is there that the Belgian administration had a criminal plan to murder Lumumba. And that's why they sent him to Katanga. This is very clear. And this kind of criminal plan is very common. I mean, it's just you ask another state or another party to do the dirty job. You know, they sent Lumumba to Katanga saying, oh, we don't know what's going to happen over there. And of course they know, and this is shown by all their diplomat cables, by their letters. And so our opinion is that we hope to have a court this year, in 2018, to consider the case, investigation is finished, and that the case has to be sent to court for a decision. Because, as in your case, we have old persons, but the accused are getting older and older. So in the beginning they were 12, now I think there remain like 6 or 7. So we have to go fast, because we don't want them to die, because if they die, the criminal investigation and the criminal case is over.
Thank you, Christophe. That was extremely inspiring. I want to obviously come back to this case and other thoughts you might share with us. But Let me now turn to Nyaka Mboro. When you've left your home country of Tanzania in the late 70s, your grandmother had you promise to bring back from Germany the skull of one of the leaders of the resistance movement against the German colons, who had been hung and whose head was decapitated and stolen, shipped to Germany. You've now spent several decades here in Germany fighting for the return of human remains of people who were colonized and murdered by the Germans and whose skulls and human remains were confiscated for research purposes and other racist pretenses. Tell us, first of all, this is quite an obscure part of history that not everyone is aware of, including Germans, the German history in Tanzania, what happened. And tell us about the meaning of these skulls being taken away from their land after these murders, and what, from your personal perspective and from your family perspective, what it represents politically, spiritually, culturally, to the communities there.
Thank you. Anyway, I don't know where to start, but let me first start that Tanzania was under the German colony. It was not just only Tanzania, it was that colony which was known as German East Africa. It does include today's Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi. So, as a German colony, it is not yet a lot being talked here or elsewhere as we have been handling the case of Namibia. But if we look the history, what happened there in Tanzania, in Rwanda and in Burundi, it is not that far different to what happened in Namibia. There's where I will start. You find Tanzania fall under the German rule, let us say, in 1885, when the so-called Berlin Africa Conference ended up in February 1885. From there, the Germans had German East Africa, but the colony wasn't secured. They have to secure their colony. How to secure it? Because you find people in Tanzania or in Rwanda or in Burundi or elsewhere too in Africa, they didn't agree to be colonized by anyone from the decision of the meeting here in Berlin. So now they have to start from a region to secure the colony, to accept. And they were collecting something which is known as local treaties that to force. You find, before then we had these so-called chiefdoms. We didn't have a central government, which we are having today, but we had chiefdoms, regions which they were states, I will say, which they were states. So then every state or every region has to sign this treaty that they do accept they are under German colony. So to start with, then the Germans, they found it wasn't easy that people did agree to be under them. So they sent someone known as Wissmann, who then he has to form a force, a defense force, and this one was known as Schutztruppe in German, in English, there will be protective force. I don't know whom this protective force was protecting. Anyway, it was protecting the colony. So then you find then they had something known as Strafe Expedition, punishment excursions from a region to a region. When the chief of that region accepts very quickly to be under German colony, then okay, and he signs the treaty, then things were somehow for those people under him easily. But most of them, they didn't agree that way. So you find then there were wars already. People refusing to sign these local treaties. And you find they were very clever how to form this Schutztruppe in Tanzania. It is not like it was in Namibia, where you find the Schutztruppe, which was really a German force, German soldiers. But in Tanzania, it was different. They took people from neighboring countries. They took the Shangani people from Mozambique. They took the Zulu people from South Africa and the people from Sudan to form this Schutztruppe, because they knew that if they take the Tanzanians, they will not achieve their mission. So is when now they started from a region to a region. And you find the Germans always, they say, you know, yes, we had colonies in Africa, but for a very, very short time. And we were totally loved by the people there. I've been here and there, and always I get shocked about it. Even today, when I go outside, I will hear that too. I've been hearing that. So it wasn't that way. So it was really permanent wars. And we lost a lot of people. So through this kind of so-called excursion punishment, they came to the region where I'm from. I'm from Kilimanjaro, under the slopes of Kilimanjaro. And when the German that came to Tanzania, of course, they liked the area because Kilimanjaro is a mountainous area. It is beautiful. The climate fits to European. It is like in Switzerland. And so you find they really wanted to have all the villages there. And people also didn't want to give up these villages. And they didn't want to be under the leadership of German colony. So that's how it comes. By then, I was not living, but my grandmother, who started telling me all this, what I'm trying to tell here, really, not just only I learned it at school, I learned very, very late in the school, but always every evening from my grandmother, she always tell me about the German, how it was, about the German, how it was. And is where you find then in Kilimanjaro, one chief known as Meli didn't want the German leadership. His brother, who was the chief, Rindi, did collaborate with the Germans to force the other village. They were such kind of also, to force the neighboring chief so that the Germans, they will take their cows, the cattle, and young women to the other village. But this Meli, he did see that, and he did promise himself, when now, you my brother, when you are gone, I will take you over, and I will show these people we don't want them. So when he came to power, then he started fighting with the German. And of course, we didn't have weapon. We didn't have modern weapons. If there was a gun, it could be two or three. Just only people they were depending, just only on a bow, arrow, and spears, or clubs, and so on. So you find they were easily defeated. And always, when they are defeated, they took captives, those who were front. And of course, the chief, Mangi Meli, was, and the German, the punishment which always they did really love is to hang people. So he was hanged with other fellows, six. This is how my grandmother used to tell me. But this Mangi, our Mangi Meli, was so strong that he didn't die so easily, because the others, six, died very easily. But the Germans, of course, they did put a note there to torture him, to show the people how you can suffer when you don't accept them. It is later, but when she was telling me, I did really believe that he was that strong. But my grandmother took he was strong. So at the end, of course, they shot him dead. And what they used to do, they did also in Namibia. They chop off the head. And you find when they chop off the head, then the head must be cooked and the skin and hair must be removed. And you find this task was given to the women and especially the wives or daughters, and being packed and sent to Germany. There are a lot of them, not just only this one which I'm mentioning is where I started off. So when really I grew up, I went to school, I started teaching in Tanzania, and I had a scholarship to come here in Germany to do my master's in civil engineering, because by that time, with the young government in Tanzania, anyway, I couldn't do my master's there. By that time, nowadays it is possible, but that time it wasn't possible. That's how I landed up here. And of course, I had to go home to my grandma to say that now I'm leaving the country, I'm going to Germany. And when she heard that, she went outside. There is a kind of rejoicing, something like that, with a kind of a really, so people, they know that is something very, very interesting. And then you find that the whole village, the people gathered around there. Oh, what is going on? Oh, she said, my man is going to Germany, because already my grandfather was already dead, because it has also to do with the German colonialism. But today I'm not going to talk about it because it will never end up. So he said that he's going there, and he has already promised me that he's going to bring back the head of Mangi Meli. I don't like that word skull, even we don't use it at home, although we have it in Kiswahili to the skull and, but we use skulls just only for the animals, for the cattle, or buffaloes which are lying in the forest. Those they, we call them skull, but these ones, still we call them head. So he's going to bring back the head of our Mangi Meli, and we are going to bury him according to our rituals and traditions and customs, and things will be okay again, because they believe when there is the weather, the climate, the rain didn't come as supposed to come, oh yes, because we haven't buried our Mangi Meli. These people, our own people, our ancestors, they are somewhere else where I came to find that they are in the basement here. They are somewhere else. We haven't, but now he's going to bring him back. And all these kind of catastrophes or sicknesses which are coming and they will never come again. So anyway, I had a task. I was already assigned. I have to do that. And up to now, The way I'm sitting here, I haven't done that. Not that I didn't work on it. I worked on it, but how difficult is it? It is where now I will come again to leave these so-called punishment excursions which happened. You find also there was a really great war, a colonial great war in Africa, which really happened, and it was in Tanzania, and it was known as Maji Maji. In English, they called it Maji Maji Rebellion. Again, I don't like that, rebellion. My people, my ancestors are fighting to keep their land, and then you are calling them their rebels. You find, anyway, even in the books, even today, the rebels. So this great war, which happened in 1905 to 1907, it was parallel to what happened in Namibia in 1904 to 1908. It wasn't that different. The difference is that you find more than 20 different groups of people, so-called tribes in English, came together. They were tired of German colonialism. They said, now we have to fight them because their land was being taken away. They were forced to work in the so-called settlers' farms and without wage whatsoever. And even the missionaries, they were the mastermind. They were the ones who even came to the idea to introduce tax, head tax. So every head has to pay a tax. And when you fail to pay a tax, then you are going to be in prison. But anyway, did we have prisons? Really, there were not prisons there. The prisons were the settlers' farms. Because to force these people to work to the farms, it wasn't that easy. And the Christians, the good church, came to this idea. Let us introduce the tax, then you can have easily the people, because they knew that no one has that money to pay the tax. No one had that money. So easily we can have people working. And that's where then you find this Maji Maji war came, and it is really, it was worse. In Tanzania, we didn't have the desert. In Namibia, they had the desert. They could push the Herero people, the Nama people, or Damara to the desert to die there without food, without something to drink. But in Tanzania, they didn't have this desert. What they did, they chose another strategy, which is known here in German as Verbrannte Erde, just only burning earth. Just what they did, they set fire on the fields, on the houses, whether there were children in, whether old people in, whether old women in. They did die there. And the number is not known exactly. The figure which they did give, which we find in the books, and around 300,000, which is over three times what happened in Namibia. But really the figure, it can come even to 500,000 or more. And also then you find here also too, there were captives, especially the leaders, chiefs, and from all these tribes. They were taken as captives, and they were hanged one by one every day till hundreds were hanged. And also what they did, they chopped off the heads, and they are lying here. This war took from the central part of Tanzania to the southern part. Someone was here in October, we had a conference. He comes from this area. He's also a chief. And really, in the conference, you were there. He was crying because also the skull, now I'm using that word, the head of his grandfather is also here. And you find what they did in this area? How they did bury them? The grave is like that, so they bury just only the abdomen here, and they leave this small part here. It is still there. They are still there waiting the head to come back so that they can complete their burial. And still they are waiting today, exactly the time I'm talking here.
Jelka, what are the German authorities and museums claiming for their defense?
What they are claiming, we have already found that they are in the museums, they are in the depots. Here in Berlin, they are under the Foundation Prussian Cultural Heritage. They are the one now who are taking care of it. Before, they were in the charity. Now is the Foundation Prussian Cultural Heritage who are holding them. And we, with my friend there, Christian, Berlin post-colonial, we have tried our best to go to these people, to talk to them, and watch at the end they did answer us. Before, they did deny. They don't have any of them. But after putting a great pressure to them, years, it took years, then they did agree. Here in Berlin, you find there are around 8,000, not just only from Tanzania, also from other colonies, also from Namibia, Cameroon, and Togo, and some other countries too in Africa and elsewhere, like in Australia, from the Aborigines, and also from South America and so on. There from various areas. But you find really in Germany, East Africa, in Tanzania now, you know, already the figure which we did find, around 100, but just only from Rwanda, this small area there, which was a region during the colonial borders, it is more than 1,000, which are here. So then, we had a discussion with them, and at the end, what they do say is that we have to do the provenance researches to see whether these skulls are not legal here. So I did ask them, which are legal, could you please tell me? You hang people, you chop the head off and take it here, and now you're telling me about legally and not legally. But that's what they say, okay, thank you. Then when is it going to be done? Yeah, at the moment time, we don't have finances to finance such a research. That's why I cannot. But the same people are the same, the ones who are now are rebuilding the castle of the colonialists, the Wilhelms. Someone did talk about Wilhelm here already, about the Wilhelms, where now the Humboldt Forum is going to come in. And in this Humboldt Forum is where they will exhibit some objects which were looted during these wars, which I'm talking about, not just only in German colonies and also other colonies, like you will find, you know, you've been in the Ethnological Museum here in Berlin about Benin bronzes and a lot of them. And in Tanzania, I don't know how many, hundred thousands we have there. I've been there. I couldn't count them because there are too many, because almost at that time they took every object which was there. And it's the one which are going to be exhibited here. I don't include them to the heads, to the human remains. I do take them separate, but you find they are the same people whom also we have put demands that we need them to be brought back, especially those ritual objects. They are ritual objects which are very, very important to us, to people groups in Africa. And for instance, there is a ritual object from a group of people in Cameroon, and they do perform their rituals every year. But this object was the one which always to make these rituals complete. Nowadays, they are doing the rituals without this object. And it is here in Berlin, in the Ethnological Museum. It is there. And the Cameroonians who are in Europe, they are also performing such rituals every year here in Europe. And we talk to them, might be this year, they will perform the rituals in front of the Ethnological Museum. I'll be very happy to see how they are going to react.
Thank you, Nyaka. We're going to turn to Christian Beaumarius, who did a lot of research on another part, another obscured part of German colonial history, which is Germans' ruthless rule in Cameroon. And you've written the book Der Gute Deutsch, The Good German. And tell us about the context which you talk about in the book and why you decided to write this book.
Ich darf auf Deutsch antworten, natürlich. Ich kann Deutsch eindeutig besser als Englisch, mein Defizit. Das Wort Maji-Maji-Aufstand fiel gerade schon in Deutsch-Ostafrika. Wenn man von den Toten hört, also den Größenordnungen, über die man da reden muss, wie viele Opfer es gab, also wie viele Opfer von Massenmorden, dann mag das vielleicht seltsam anmuten, dass ich ein Buch schreibe über zwei Justizmordopfer namens Manga Bell und Ngozi Dinh. Ngozi Dinh war ein Mitarbeiter von Manga Bell. Warum habe ich nun gerade diese Themenverengung vorgezogen? Es ist ganz einfach. Wir sprechen zwar immer von Aufständen, also von Maji-Maji-Aufstand, Herero-Aufstand. Es waren ja gar keine Aufstände. Es waren, wenn man so will, Widerstandshandlungen. Also das Wort Aufstand trifft es da eigentlich nicht. Was machte aber Manga Bell? Manga Bell wehrte sich gegen eindeutig, wir sagen offensichtlich, rechtswidrige Maßnahmen der deutschen Kolonialherren, aber nicht durch den Aufruf zur Waffengewalt, sondern das Gegenteil. Er sagte, wir machen das auf rechtliche Weise. Und das wirklich Perverse ist, dass der Rechtsweg, auf dem Manga Bell und Ngozi Dinh schritten, genau der Weg in den Tod war, in ihren Untergang. Also natürlich kann man davon ausgehen, hätten sie Waffengewalt angewandt, wären sie auch umgekommen. Aber hier waren es zwei Justizmorde, wie es sie auch in der deutschen Kolonialzeit relativ selten gab, in dieser Brutalität. Um was geht es? Also auch die deutsche Kolonialzeit in Kamerun beginnt 1884 mit einem Vertrag, den die Douala, das ist ein Volk an der Küste, mit den deutschen künftigen Kolonialherren schließen. Die Douala sind ein Küstenvolk und ein Händlervolk. Händler meint hier, sie leben neben der Fischerei von dem Zwischenhandel mit dem Hinterland. Es geht da um Kautschuk, Palmöl und solche Dinge. Und davon leben die eigentlich seit langer Zeit prächtig. Dann kommen die Deutschen, man macht einen Vertrag mit ihnen. Der sieht so aus, dass die Deutschen am Küstenstreifen Schutzgewalt ausüben. Darunter stellten sich die Douala-Chefs vor, wenn es intern, also zwischen Douala-Mitgliedern, zu Auseinandersetzungen kommen sollen, die Deutschen schlichten. Dafür gibt man denen etwas Hoheitsgewalt, aber es geht nicht darum, dass die Deutschen eine Kolonialmacht in Kamerun werden. Kamerun war damals auch wirklich nur dieser Küstenstreifen, das war nicht das Land. Das wurde es nach der Afrika-Konferenz 1885. Plötzlich wurde Kamerun von dem Küstenstreifen zu einem Bereich von 495.000 Quadratkilometern. Das war etwas kleiner als das Deutsche Reich damals. So, in diesem Vertrag steht nun, also den deutsche Vertreter von Hamburger Handelshäusern mit Douala-Chefs schließen, darunter King Bell. Das war der, wenn man so will, renommierteste Clan-Chef. Könige gab es nicht. Das war eine europäische Zuschreibung, dass man ihn King nannte. Es war einfach einer der ehrwürdigen Clan-Repräsentanten. Also, und er war der Großvater von Manga Bell, dem traurigen Helden meines Buches. King Bell und einige andere unterschreiben also, dass die Deutschen sich da niederlassen dürfen. Aber zwei Dinge müssen die Deutschen den Douala garantieren. Nämlich erstens, dass sie weiterhin ungestört Handel treiben dürfen mit dem Hinterland. Zweitens, dass der Grund und Boden, auf dem die Douala siedeln, ihnen bleiben würde. Also das heißt, die Deutschen haben kein Recht, Siedlungsgrund ihnen wegzunehmen. Was den ersten Punkt angeht, so war den Deutschen sofort klar, dass sie ihn brechen würden. Deswegen waren sie ja da. Sie wollten Handel treiben. Das konnten sie aber nur, wenn man eben den Douala die Möglichkeit, Handel zu treiben, nähme. Ich mache es mal kurz. Ich will jetzt nicht die gesamte deutsche Kolonialpolitik in Kamerun darstellen. Was aber klar war, war in den nächsten Jahren vor allem unter dem Gouverneur Putkammer, dass die Penetration Kameruns mit deutschen Truppen stattfinden würde zugunsten des deutschen Handels, also der Händler. Das fand dann auch statt mit einem riesigen Blutzoll, den die Afrikaner leisten mussten. Aber dann, 1910, haben die deutschen Kolonialherren die Vorstellung, es wäre ganz günstig für die Kolonialpolitik der Deutschen in Afrika insgesamt. Man hätte einen großen Hafen. Dazu muss man in Douala als dafür ausgesehener Stützpunkt Douala-Stadt, also hieß auch der Ort, räumen, stellt sich heraus, um Platz zu haben für neue Häuser, aber auch eben für das Hafengebiet selber. Und die Douala, die bis dahin mehrheitlich in Douala-Stadt lebten, müssten raus. Das hatte nun nicht nur ökonomische Gründe, sondern auch rassische Gründe. Wir sagen, man wollte sie loswerden und also segregieren, sprich ab in die Sümpfe. Und jetzt verweist der frisch zum neuen Chef aufgestiegene Manga Bell, der Enkel des damaligen Vertragspartners King Bell, auf die Rechtslage und sagt, ihr könnt uns nicht einfach den Boden wegnehmen, wie es euch passt. Hier gibt es eine Abmachung, die ist eindeutig, wir bleiben. Stur waren die Douala eigentlich nie, wenn es um Kauffragen ging. Die handelten sehr munter mit ihren Grundstücken und man handelte eben passende Preise aus. Jetzt war es so, dass der Grundstückswert offenbar bei ca. 20 Reichsmark lag. Die Deutschen boten 20 Pfennig. Und sagten eben die Douala, das geht so nicht. Und jetzt kommt es also zu einem Konflikt, der sich immer weiter hochschaukelt. Die Deutschen wollen die Douala unbedingt aus Douala raushaben und die Grundstücke nicht nur haben, damit die Douala sie nicht mehr haben, sondern damit die Deutschen damit handeln können. Das heißt, das Geld, das die Douala bisher mit ihrem Grundstückshandel einstrichen, wollten die Deutschen selber einstreichen. So. Was macht Manga Bell? Manga Bell redet mit seinen Leuten und sagt, wir wehren uns zum Beispiel, indem wir ein Telegramm an den Deutschen Reichstag schicken. Das konnte Manga Bell so einfach sagen, weil er sehr gut Deutsch sprach. Er lebte in seiner Jugend einige Jahre in Deutschland, in dem baden-württembergischen Aalen. Jurist war er nicht, das heißt es zwar manchmal, aber er war kein Jurist. Er hat nach der mittleren Reife abgebrochen und musste zurück nach Douala. Aber er konnte eben sehr gut Deutsch, kannte auch viele Deutsche, liebte auch die deutsche Literatur. Er kannte mit Sicherheit Goethe, Schiller, Lessing und so besser als die meisten Kolonialherren. So, und dieser rechtlich denkende Manga Bell sagt also, wir unterrichten und alarmieren den Deutschen Reichstag, wollen doch mal sehen, ob wir nicht Hilfe bekommen. Und natürlich am offensten für die Anfrage oder für diese Unterrichtung war die SPD damals. man musste nicht lange sondieren, sondern sagte gleich, also da müssten wir doch etwas tun. Und sogar die Zentrumsabgeordneten, einige von ihnen zumindest, Herr Erzberger, sagten, die Afrikaner haben da durchaus einen Punkt, wir können nicht einfach denen die Grundstücke wegnehmen, nur weil wir sie brauchen. Ich glaube, wir haben gar nicht so wahnsinnig viel Zeit. Ne? Ich mache es also noch kürzer als kurz, also verkürze illegitim und berichte nur ganz kurz, wie es weiterging, nämlich so, dass die Douala, also Ngozi Dinh, der Mitarbeiter von Mangabeil, dass sie Ngozi Dinh nach Deutschland schicken wollten, was sie nicht durften. Der damalige Gouverneur sagte Reiseverbot, also Ausreiseverbot. Alle bleiben hier. Ngozi Dinh reiste trotzdem, kam nach Deutschland, wurde festgenommen. Und er tritt dann hier etwas los, was es in der deutschen Kolonialpolitik vorher und nachher nie gegeben hat. Er macht eine echte Kampagne gegen die Enteignung in Douala. Mobilisiert also den Reichstag, mobilisiert die deutschen Medien, mobilisiert deutsche Anwälte, mobilisiert vor allem den deutschen Publizisten Helmut Gerlach, vielleicht kennen ihn einige von Ihnen noch. Von ihm kommt das sehr schöne Buch Von rechts nach links. Er fing nämlich ganz konservativ an und mit den Jahren wurde er immer linker. So, und Herr Gerlach kannte von einer Kamerunreise Mangabeil und sagte, ich helfe euch. Es wurde also der Reichstag, wie auch die Öffentlichkeit, mobilisiert. Die Folge war, dass dann tatsächlich der Budgetausschuss des Deutschen Reichstags sagte, wir müssen hier erstmal prüfen. Das heißt, die Enteignung stoppt, es findet keine weitere Enteignung statt. Aber der deutsche Gouverneur weiß sich zu wehren und wie das im Einzelnen ablief, weiß man bis heute nicht. Es tritt aber ein, sozusagen, dass ein reitender Bote nach Douala kommt und sagt, der Bruder von Mangabeil forderte uns auf, die Afrikaner in Kamerun, das sind ungefähr 200 Völker, wir sollten aufstehen gegen die Deutschen, also Krieg. Daraufhin schickt der deutsche Gouverneur hier zum Reichstag ein Telegramm und sagt, Mangabeil plant einen Aufstand, nehmen Sie bitte sofort seinen Mitarbeiter Ngozi Dinh fest. Was man auch macht, in Kamerun nimmt man Mangabeil fest und es kommt zu einer Anklage wegen Hochverrats, klar. Unabhängige Richter gab es nicht, das führe ich jetzt nicht weiter aus zur Rechtslage. Es war völlig klar, dass das deutsche Recht in Kamerun nicht angewendet werden würde. Vor allem war klar, dass das Verfahren gegen Mangabeil und Ngozi Dinh offensichtlich rechtswidrig, also rechtsstaatswidrig wäre. Darum ging es auch nicht. Worum ging es? Es ging darum, Mangabeil daran zu hindern, das Recht durchzusetzen. Also man wollte ihn sozusagen auf dem Rechtsweg ausschalten, damit er nicht auf dem Rechtsweg zu seinem Recht komme. Das machte den Fall für mich so interessant. Und bis heute wartet Mangabeil und Ngozi Dinh auf eine Rehabilitierung. Ich war bei Herrn Ströbele vor einigen Monaten, oder vor einem Jahr schon, und regte damals an, man könnte doch eine kleine Anfrage machen an den Außenminister, ob der nicht mal eine Rehabilitierung für möglich halte. Dafür braucht es ja nicht viel, das ist ja formlos. Und dann ließ Steinmeier über seinen Staatssekretär Roth antworten, ja, sehr feine Idee. Man sei ja auch in solchen Fragen prinzipiell sehr offen, nur dafür bräuchte es eine Äußerung aus Kamerun. Will sagen, dass der Kameruner Präsident oder aus dem Clan von Mangabeil sich irgendjemand in diesem Sinne äußern müsse, wonach Mangabeil doch bitte rehabilitiert werden solle. Nun, ich denke mal, dass das Außenministerium genau wusste, dass es so eine Äußerung niemals geben wird. Der Kameruner Präsident, will sagen Diktator, interessiert sich dafür überhaupt nicht. Ich sprach mit dem Botschafter in Deutschland, der mir auch klar machte, dass es nichts Irrelevanteres für ihn gäbe, als die Frage, wird Mangabeil rehabilitiert, der bis heute in Kamerun als ein Volksheld gilt. Was den Clan von Mangabeil angeht, so ist er sich völlig uneinig, für wen, mit wem, zu welchem Zweck man überhaupt antreten sollte. Will sagen, wenn die Deutschen es nicht von sich selbst machen, wird es zu einer Rehabilitierung niemals kommen. Die Frage ist nur, warum? verlangt das Auswärtige Amt einen Wunsch aus Kamerun. Es ist mir nicht klar, wenn jeder sagt und jeder weiß, es waren Justizmorde, warum sagen wir nicht 100 Jahre später, wir heben die Urteile auf?
Vielen Dank. Thank you very much, Christian. As I disclaimed in the beginning, we have a very rich panel filled with different stories, different contexts, different battles, different ways to challenge the status quo and be in solidarity and have an impact. I had a few follow-up questions for the speakers, but we are reaching the very limit. So I thought instead, maybe if there's one or two questions from the audience, we could take that. If not, and if you could please be obviously thank you if you could please be concise and we will try to respond concisely. Thank you.
Short.
Time is ready. Bonjour à tout le monde. Est-ce que je peux m'exprimer en français?
Oui, alors je peux essayer de traduire.
Je m'en doutais pas.
Unless there's French, that would be... OK. Dan?
Alors, je voudrais bien poser la question à l'avocat Christophe concernant le cas de Lumumba. Souvent des questions, c'est comme des critiques, je m'excuserai. Pourquoi est-ce qu'on adresse ce cas comme si c'était un cas familial de Lumumba, alors qu'il était un homme d'État? Dans le cas où on pourrait faire toutes sortes de justice, il faut que ce soit pour le Zaïre, la Démocratique République Congo. Ce n'est pas un issue familial. On a perdu un chef d'État. Et que c'est un État belge qui a fait aussi ça. Mais j'aimerais bien qu'on puisse suivre le cas comme État par État pour que les deux pays apprennent et qu'ils puissent aussi récompenser quoi que ce soit. Merci. Et j'ai une autre question concernant l'Indonésie. Quand on avait fait la justice...
Excusez-moi, si vous me permettez de traduire au moins jusqu'à l'instant pour pas que je perde le fil.
Merci.
The first question is to Christophe about the Lumumba. It's more of a critique. Why do we talk about it as a family case when in fact it's justice for Zaïre, justice for DRC? It's a state case more than anything. It's a question of one state to another. And that for both states to learn from one another. And now a question on Indonesia.
J'ai oublié aussi un petit point concernant le même cas de Lumumba. On disait que c'était crime et moral. Je trouve que ce n'est pas moral ce qui s'est passé contre Lumumba. Si quelqu'un, un chef d'État a été tué, c'est un crime politique qui... touche à toute la population, c'est plus que moral.
Mm-hmm. And it goes beyond a moral case. It's a question of accountability.
Mm-hmm. Ma dernière question concernant l'Indonésie, la récompense qu'on a fait de 500 000. Est-ce que vous trouvez vraiment que c'est une justice? Les paiements qu'on va donner aux avocats, c'est plus que ça, et je vois pas ce qu'on a fait vraiment pour soigner ou régler ce qui s'est passé de Netherlands contre l'Indonésie et un village qui a été détruit et qu'on dit que 500 000 c'était un règlement de compte. Merci.
The last question is saying 500,000 euros in the case of dollars in the case of Indonesia. Is that really justice? That's probably the amount that was paid to lawyers. On this, I can say that they are lawyers paid by legal aid services, so I don't think so. But what are we really doing to solve the real pain? Thank you. I take one more last question. Hannah, maybe?
Thank you. It's also a question to Christophe Marchand. I'm just wondering whether, in his view, this jurisprudence, if we could call it that, at least the fact that crimes that were considered internal disturbances are now considered war crimes in Belgium, whether it opens up possibilities for other colonial crimes and litigation. I'm thinking particularly about crimes committed by France in Algeria that for now are covered by the amnesty law. I mean, maybe that's too technical, but as a question, but if it's not, and if we can get sort of a broad answer, I'd love to hear it.
Thank you. Christophe.
Yes, I will respond very quickly to what you said about the qualification of internal or not internal problems. I think it's just a question of fact. I mean, it's just has to be responded by international law. Is there a war situation or not? And if it was a war situation in the war between France and Algeria, and you have to respond to your question, of course international law should apply with all these consequences, also on statute of limitation. Now about Lumumba family case and not a state case, I think we can respond like talking about what we are doing in this case is sort of strategic litigation. It means that we have some objectives in strategic litigation for the family, but it's objectives that go beyond the case, that are bigger than the case. These are the objectives we've been discussing, as I said, with the CCHR and other lawyers from the US and with universities. And those objectives are to recognize that the assassination of Lumumba is not a family case, but it's an international case. It's a situation, it's a political crime, it's a war crime, and that's what we try to achieve. And afterwards, we can build on other victims. For example, we've been approached by the family of the other ministers who were with Lumumba in the same place and who were killed also in Katanga. And we said, and because they wanted to come in the case, and we said, no, we want to have, in this kind of case, so complex, we really have to have one idea to simplify the case as much as possible. So we said, no, we only keep with assassination of Lumumba, and then we go, if we have jurisprudence, case law, a good decision, we can build further on other crimes of colonization of or other victims of this assassination.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe also on the first question, because my thoughts came up when you start a small case. Of course, you can raise the question why you shouldn't be doing it on behalf of a whole community or indeed a whole country. We also apply the same strategy. We start small, extremely small, because judges are not per se heroes or game changers or politicians. They want to, you know, remain within their own fields, and they don't want to be criticized, and you know that they go beyond borders that have been set for them. So the smaller, but at the same time, principal cases have larger chances of success, and we all really operate along the same lines. What I've started for, I don't know how many, 500 children from the beginning from Indonesia, without any doubt we would have failed. But it was the idea at the time that there were only 9 widows. Okay, well that's doable. And then we continued and it turned out to be, you know, so many more. So I think that's a matter of strategy. With regard to the 500,000, I think I may have not been clear. $500,000 were the, or euros, were the humanitarian aid. Was the European aid donation by our Ministry of Foreign Aid. So it wasn't meant as a reparation. In fact, that was indeed the problem, that they weren't prepared to label it as reparation. It was a gift, not linked, at least not explicitly linked to the case. Whether 20,000 euros per widow is a right amount of money for the execution of your husband is a completely different story, and that's a difficult discussion. In the end, that's also a matter of personal acceptance of whether you find that the money is the correct amount, or whether you just say, well, this is wholly unacceptable, and it doesn't meet in no ways my expectations, or you know what I've gone through, or that's a different story that you can discuss.
Thank you. I think all of the speakers have illustrated this challenge to imperialism at work. And as we hear from all of these various stories, it's not something that's new. It's not something that we're creating. I think from your book and from how you were talking about Mangabell in Cameroon, using the rule of law here in Germany, saying, raising the media attention, traveling, gathering partners around the world, maybe it was one of the very first strategic litigation jurists. We also see from Lumumba that he understood really well what was the imperial project and where justice had to be done. He said justice will not be done in the West. It needs to happen and be built by people of Congo. And something else that I was mentioning in the beginning, because it's very strong, it's also something David Kennedy speaks about a lot, is how justice is built by people. And we hear in all of these stories that we're talking movements. These are individuals, they're part of a very large community of actors. So I hope this was inspiring. I'm sorry that we ran out of time. Obviously, I'm sure you're open to having people come and ask you questions. There's obviously a lot to talk about. We take a 15-minute break, and then comes the next panel, Legal Interventions Against Transnational Corporations, which also promises to be great. Thank you very much.